Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and the editor-in-chief of The Wrap. And joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey there, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon. You know, I have to admit, things didn't go the way I wanted to this week. I was hoping to... I wanted to do a feature interview with all of the directors who've been nominated for the Oscar for the best documentary feature, but like they are all over the place, right? There's like two in California, but one's in South Africa, one's in Chile, one's in Romania. So it's not really feasible to get them all together at the same time. I don't think anyone could pull it off. So that we're not going to have that, but so what do you have planned instead? Do you have something for us?
Yeah. Well, this week we'll have my discussion with the five Oscar nominated directors for films in the best documentary feature category. And miraculously we managed to speak at the same time with Maita Alberti of The Mole Agent. She's the one in Santiago, Chile. Garrett Bradley in LA for Time. Pippa Ehrlich in Cape Town, South Africa for My Octopus Teacher. Alexander Nanau, who's in Bucharest, Romania, who has Collective. And Nicole Noonan of Crip Camp, who's in Point Reyes, California. And they all talked about how they made their films and what the themes are, you know, in their films. Some are about mass incarceration through the eyes of a family that's been affected by that. There's another about corruption in the health sector, the entire health infrastructure in Romania. There's a beautiful film about the origins of the disability movement in Crip Camp. There's a very fun and funny film about a senior citizen embedded as a spy in a senior citizen facility. And there's finally a beautiful underwater film, My Octopus Teacher, that Pippa Ehrlich filmed over many years. So it was a very inspiring conversation.
I should have known if anyone could have pulled together people from all over the world, it would be. All right, we're going to have that later. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. You know, five executives at Dick Clark Productions, the company behind the Golden Globes and the upcoming Academy of Country Music Awards, have abruptly quit amid complaints of what insiders are calling a, quote, toxic culture. Multiple sources told The Wrap the chief source of tension is Amy Thurlow, president of DCP, and Mark Schimmel, the company's head of talent management. One person speaking to The Wrap said of Thurlow, quote, she's poison. She's oppressive. She's a bully. Toxic is the word that keeps coming up over and over again, end quote. Another issue for some at the company has been the fact that DCP has been silent on the firestorm swirling around the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the organization behind the Golden Globes. DC has produced the Globes for decades and has a long-standing partnership with the HFPA. Sharon, you worked on this story. Were you surprised to hear about what's been going on at Dick Clark Productions?
I was surprised. Yeah, I got a call. I was shocked. Five people quit in like the space of 3 weeks, including some of the most respected and longstanding executives there. Mark Braccio and Linda Guerin. These are top EVPs of production and programming. So this was very surprising. Dick Clark Productions, which of course was founded by the totally legendary Dick Clark, who then went on to do like Dick Clark's Rockin' Eve and all of these kinds of live entertainment shows, has been bought by MRC, which is essentially a production company run by a couple of also veteran Hollywood producers, Asif Sachu and Modi Wizik, and also with a billionaire Todd Boehly, and they have been running it for some time, and it runs the Golden Globes and the Academy of Country Music Awards, not to be confused, which I constantly do with the CMAs, the Country Music Awards. But it was very surprising to get this information. And once we started reporting it out, it like started coming out in a flood. And the thing that's tough for Dick Clark and particularly MRC is that they have been trying to clean house and have been talking sort of like in the background in Hollywood about wanting to solve their culture problem, because the MRC had to fire John Amato, who was the CEO of The Hollywood Reporter and Billboard in 2018 for, you know, there was an investigation into allegations of sexual harassment. There was an investigation into allegations of interference in the editorial. And so he left the company at that time, and there was a real issue of morale inside the company. Since then, many of our listeners may know that the Hollywood Reporter, Billboard, and that media group was spun off to Jay Penske's company, Penske Media, which now owns all of the trade publications in Hollywood except for The Wrap. Thank you very much. We're here to be your independent source. And which also is an issue, as you can see, because this is not a story that I think anybody else, any other insider trade B2B publication would have published this week about Dick Clark Productions, because Dick Clark Productions has longstanding ties to The Hollywood Reporter, which is now owned by Penske Media and which has all of the other trades. So that's a not hugely significant point, but for those who care about independent coverage of the industry, it is not insignificant, especially the people who have been calling us and wanting to explain what's going on inside the doors of that company. So I have not heard, so DCP has told us, you know, well, Amy Thurlow, who just started in the fall of 2019 as the president, she came up out of finance, has articulated a bold vision, you know, is strategic restructuring, and it's not for everybody. But I don't think that that's what's going on. In fact, the sources are coming back to me saying, hey, look, they're going to try to say we're exhausted, we're just burned out after a year of COVID. Like, that's not what's going on. They don't want to work for her, not to beat up on Amy Thurlow, because I don't know her, and she has chosen not to comment to us. So I haven't heard more than the fact that the company is standing behind her at the moment. But given that and all of the controversy going on around the HFPA and the Golden Globes, it's like, wow, it's
getting it's been very strange that they haven't commented at all. I mean, everyone, even NBC eventually came out and said something
on the Golden Globes. Clark,
on the Golden Globes and the HFPA. Yeah. I think the most telling part when I read the story is five people quit, and I don't think any of them had jobs lined up. They all just were like,
not that I'm aware of.
I mean? And nothing says, you know, this is, I've had enough, then I don't even care if I have a job lined up. I just got to get out of here. Yeah. You know, so that I think that speaks volumes about what's going on there. Mm-hmm. And I know you also, did you speak to Dick Clark's son as well? Was that
I spoke to Rack Clark. Yeah, I didn't know him, but he gave us a statement. He's Dick Clark's son, who is the executive producer of the ACM, the Academy of Country Music Awards, which are coming up on April 18th. So all of these people, four out of five people who are quitting are leaving after the ACMs. And so, you know, I don't suppose they're going to want to talk to the media anytime before they, while they're still employed there. So, you know, none of them are speaking on the record, but everybody confirmed that there's no question that they're quitting. And you're right that I don't think they have other jobs. And Rack Clark's statement to us on the record was that he was very sad to see these people leaving, because to him, they're the next generation of leaders of Dick Clark Productions. I actually asked him, how come you're not running Dick Clark Productions? And he was very humble and very charming and said, look, I'm a music production guy. I love what I do, and I am not. And DCP became a much bigger and more successful company after my father's, you know, departure. And, you know, he sort of said, my dad ran it like a mom and pop shop. And he used to empty the trash cans and make sure.
I remember the offices in Burbank. It was an iconic little office building. It was an iconic little office building right near, I used to work at Telepictures, which is in Burbank, and their offices were very close by. And it had like it looked like a house almost. It was a very weird little building.
Oh, that's really sweet. Well, Dick Clark Productions, the incarnation before the current one was right around the corner from where The Wrap is, was at the offices in Santa Monica, not far from Lionsgate, because a lot of this predated Lionsgate being a co-owner of TV Guide. A lot of that team then went to run Dick Clark Productions. So when it merged under MRC, now they moved to Beverly Hills. And I would love to hear from them how they're going to address it, because, you know, in the age of Me Too and in the age of like a week when a huge expose about the, you know, sort of legendarily bullying producer Scott Rudin comes out, it's just clear that there is no, this is not an environment anymore where people can get away with it, with the kind of behavior that's being described. And to me, it was like, well, Scott Rudin, to the Hollywood Reporter, did that expose of Scott Rudin as a cover story. It's the biggest non-secret in Hollywood that Scott Rudin is an abusive personality. You know, it was almost like a hazing ritual of being in the industry, of being his assistant, getting screamed at for a year. But you know, he's also an independent producer. He works for himself. So a lot of people are like, why aren't people, you know, doing anything about it? Well, Scott Rudin is a very successful and wealthy producer in his own right. I don't know that people are going to stop working with him. And I don't know that people are going to stop working with Dick Clark Productions, but they have some staffing holes to fill. That is for sure. Okay.
Fun fact, Dick Clark was at my parents' wedding.
Get out. Why?
He worked with my grandfather back in the day.
Oh, you're hiding all this stuff?
Connection there. Yeah, Dick Clark. Somewhere, assuming my mom hasn't burned all the wedding photos, but somewhere there exists an album where...
He was there as a guest? Dick, or he like was like...
Yeah, no, he was my grandfather invited him and he came. He's there. Okay, there's pictures of him.
Like, cool. Your cool factor just went up by like 30%. All right, let's move on though. Duly noted. Meantime, it really is like so cool. Netflix, meantime, is still the king of the streaming world, as we know, but the size of the kingdom is growing and therefore the king's share is being reduced. The Wrap has reported this week that a new set of data compiled by Ampere Analysis shows that Netflix lost 31% of its market share in the last year. So in 2019, it was at 29%. It's now at 20%. Obviously, that's not because people are leaving Netflix, because Netflix subscriber numbers, if you follow earnings reports at all, and we do, have continued to go up. But all of these other streaming services have come online. That also impacted Amazon, which dropped from 20% market share to 16%. Meantime, HBO Max and now Peacock have come online, and they're starting to, you know, take market share. But as I say, you know, the pie has grown. But do you think, Daniel, that Netflix has anything to worry about here?
I don't think so. I think, you know, they are still the king. They have such a massive head start on everyone else. They have an extensive library of content in varying degrees. I think you're seeing Disney and HBO get a bump from the pandemic because they've gained content that they normally wouldn't have. Right?
The movies like, that they're not.
Yeah, you're getting you're getting a Marvel movie next in May or I think it's in June or July when they do Black Widow that you normally wouldn't have gotten. HBO Max is getting a movie a month that normally it wouldn't have gotten until months later.
Right. Tyler just said today, if I'm not mistaken, that they are going to be putting movies back exclusively at theaters in 2022. So
yeah, it's just a 2021 bump for them.
We'll see.
I
believe it.
Yeah, the windows are, as you always like to say, are probably going to shrink, but not disappear. And Netflix did strike a deal this week also with Sony, which is sort of like one of the major studios that doesn't have a streaming arm. So now Netflix is going to be the sole provider of their, you know, they've got Morbius coming up, they've got Uncharted. So they're going to start getting some big movies to go along with all of their super bingeable shows, although I know you won't be watching Bridgerton anymore. Following the
now that Reggie Jean Page is not there, I'm out. Yes.
Yeah. So out. I think, you know, to your point, there's just a huge pie now. And yeah, they may have a smaller percentage of it, but they're still far and away the leader. I think Disney's going to keep catching up, and so is HBO, but that's to be expected.
So what this study, though, does raise as a question is what. You know, there are still only 24 hours a day for people to be consuming content, to be watching shows. And so from that perspective, that would seem to me to be something that Netflix absolutely has to be aware of. I think they were very aware that it was coming. They knew these other streaming services were coming online. And in some ways, it's remarkable that their numbers have continued to go up even though these other streaming services have come online and they have big aggressive marketing campaigns and they've had big aggressive investor days where they unveil all of these projects that are coming online either at Disney Plus or at Peacock, all of them, Viacom, all of them. So at a certain point, you do have to wonder, the thing that I'm thinking about going forward is like the amount of confusion, how hard it is to figure out where any show is. I was just chatting with my daughter yesterday, and we were both like, there's nothing to watch, which is crazy because I've been lucky enough that I have been able to watch the Oscar nominees and all these categories that have been doing showcases around, including Best Documentary, who you're going to hear from in a minute. But I mean, those are really stellar, pre-curated for me by the Academy of Motion Picture Voters, that these are going to be great films or great shorts or whatever it is. But I have to say, when I go on HBO Max, I feel bereft. Like I want to throw up my hands. I need somebody to tell me what to watch. In fact, I now know there's a documentary about Ernest Hemingway out there on Nat Geo, and I haven't figured out how to find it because Nat Geo is a streaming service. Somebody tell me, is it on Hulu? Like, where's the damn thing? I will go out and find it. You don't have to tell me. You can.
Justwatch.com is a really good site to just like type in a movie and it'll tell you where it is.
The Google. All right.
That works too. All right.
Anyway.
All right. Finally, this week, the Oscars are pushing forward with their plan to make this year's ceremony as unvirtual as possible. To that end, the Academy announced this week that nominees and their guests can qualify for the essential work purpose waiver, and that anyone traveling into Los Angeles County must quarantine for 10 days before the live show and other Academy organized activities. Nominees are not allowed to interact with people outside of their household, and they must also have a minimum of 2 COVID PCR tests performed by Academy vendors and 3 tests in the week leading up to the show itself. They are still planning to set up some European hubs with live satellite feeds to accommodate international nominees who are unable to make the trip. Sharon, this last weekend were the SAG Awards, which I personally loved, and it was all pre-taped, an hour long. I thought it went fantastically. Mm-hmm. But do you think the Oscars are still doing the right thing to try and really push for this fully live experience?
Well, I have another question before we can get to that one. This is all stuff that people have to do even if they're vaccinated. They have to quarantine for 10 days and get 2 COVID PCR tests before and 3 tests in the week leading up to the show itself. Like quarantine for 10 days and 5 tests and you're vaccinated? Like, what's the friggin' point of a vaccination?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, we've had some arguments this week about what vaccination means in terms of how transmittable you are, but I'm not going to start that again because I don't even know the answer. It's but like, it just seems better safe than sorry, I
guess. Here's the answer. It's 97%. 97%. There are like 3 studies that came out. Again, let's say they keep studying this and they keep finding that the COVID vaccine is extremely effective, not only in keeping you from getting any symptoms of the virus, but of giving it out, shedding it to other people. I mean, if we don't, and including for the new variants. So that's, but there is still a whole lot of confusion around that message. I mean, that is why we're arguing internally about how effective the vaccine is here. But I am not trying to cherry pick information, but like, why are we going through all of this if it's not to be able to gather again safely? So I don't know. Anyhow, I'm not going to tell the Academy what to do. The Academy can do whatever it wants. You're asking, is it worth it to go through all of that? Well, that's a really good question. I will point out that the SAG Awards were down like 2/3.
Oh, the ratings were terrible.
Ratings were like,
but it was the best award show I saw. My wife and I watched and we kept looking at each other like, this is really good. They had great little bits. It zipped along. I mean, they gave out 13 awards in an hour.
Yeah, that's an fantastic hour. Like, zip, zip, zip. It was pre-taped for those of you who didn't know.
Yes, it was all pre-taped.
But it all seemed very spontaneous. But I mean, you know, people are reacting in real time, even if it's pre-taped. So that's all valid. But the Oscars have needed so much help for so many years as a telecast that it's hard to even weigh in as to whether it makes sense to go through all that effort to have the nominees together. Clearly, there seems to be some value that the Academy sees in bringing the nominees in person. I don't know what it is. The Cannes Film Festival behaves more or less the same way. They hung on till the very last minute a year ago before they pushed the festival and kept trying to say it would be in person in the fall before they had to cancel it. And this year, they're again saying it's going to be in person in July, even though the whole friggin' country's on lockdown for the 4th time. So, and they've only vaccinated like 6% or 7 or 8% of the population compared to like 30% here. So I don't know is the answer. Is that a good answer?
Yeah, I think that's fine. I don't know either. I it just seems, I mean, I've said this multiple times. I really wish they would bring a host in. I think that would liven things up because to your point, I do think that the Academy Awards have needed a jolt in the last couple of years. The Grammys sort of did what I think that the Oscars are trying to do in that it seems like they're going to like, you know, have sections for each category. Like, I don't think everyone's going to like sit together and I think they're going to use multiple locations. So
yeah, I thought that was clever how the Grammys did it live. I thought it was fun to watch. The Oscar ceremony has long been way too long, 3.5 hours, sometimes 3:45, depending on the year. And
gotta make that money. How
quickly or slowly, you know, the winners walk up the podium, up to the podium. Yeah, SAG is not the same stakes money wise to the network as the Oscars. So anyway, I think that let me just conclude by saying award ceremonies are broken. Just overall, they're just broken. And somebody needs to figure out how to fix it. So somebody smart out there, please come up with some ideas.
Yeah, maybe I'm alone in this. I really feel like the SAG Awards did something. The pre-tape was very zippy. It was. No, I know. I guess so. It was just me and
ask
my wife.
Nielsen.
I guess. All right.
I'm just kidding.
I've been wrong before. I'll be wrong again. Probably.
I will ponder. I will ponder your opinion there.
All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something maybe she's a little more riled up about, her Wax Off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. My Wax On this week is a kind of, can I be a medium? Can I wax medium on? A couple
you
weeks
can
ago.
Like a half wax, yeah.
Yeah, half wax. It's a half wax. A couple weeks ago, I was very upset that Joe Biden was not seizing the moment after the two more mass shootings to get more gun restrictions passed that have been wildly popular with the American public for many, many years, whether that's background checks, whether that's a waiting period, whether that's banning assault weapons, just to name a few of the issues that have very broad, and I'm talking like 70% and up support, the kinds of support you actually never see on any issue. And he hadn't done anything. Well, he's finally apparently decided that he can divert a little bit of attention from his infrastructure huge bill and issue some executive orders that will, now that I guess the new term is gun safety, that will promote gun safety as, instead of saying gun control, because gun control is a scary word for people who like the Second Amendment. So there you go. So I'll give him a medium wax on for that because we're still not talking any kind of ban on assault weapons, which we need and which worked when we did it in the 90s. And we're not talking about, you know, federal background checks. We're talking about these ghost guns, which I'm not an expert and I don't know enough about, but they're something and they're a start and we need it. And thank you, Joe Biden. My wax off is just want to remind you that the monster in the closet is still here. Harvey Weinstein has appealed his rape conviction and is poised to be extradited to Los Angeles. There's a hearing on that on Monday, so we may get him over here for him to face multiple charges here in Los Angeles. I personally can't believe that he's made it through COVID and this much incarceration, and he's still around. But he is. And my wax off is there's a monster in the closet. Daniel.
I just want to say real quick, rest in peace, Howard Weitzman, passed away this week.
Yeah.
A legendary entertainment attorney. I never had the chance personally to speak with him, but I worked on legal stories for a large portion of my career. So I dealt with stuff that involved him for years. I mean, he represented everyone. And
OJ, Arnold,
Michael Jackson, he worked for the Jackson estate for years and just, yeah. I never heard anyone
after Michael
say anything
Jackson
bad about him.
Died. Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you say that because for somebody who worked on the OJ case could really make you a target of hatred. you know, because that was the OG defense team, although he did resign from the defense team at a certain point. But I did deal with him as a reporter many times over the years because he was always working on these massively high profile cases.
The biggest ones, always.
The biggest ones. And the Jackson Estate was a huge, huge friggin' one with John Branca, another important figure, and who was like the guy who was in charge of Michael's estate. So, and I had talked to him actually last year around, you know, the Ron Myers departure from Universal. He was handling that. He was still dealing with that, but he, my understanding is he'd been sick for a number of years with cancer, and but the end came kind of quickly. And yeah, I'm with you there. Rest in peace, Howard Weitzman.
Yeah, and just to wax off real quick, can we stop listening to Dr. Drew?
Yeah, just totally.
Just about anything. He had a tweet this week about the idea that having to show your COVID vaccination card is somehow restrictive to people. Like,
what's going on with
that's
like
the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like reality, like this is the world we live in at the moment. We'll all be vaccinated soon and this will be less of a thing. But for now,
also, the idea like, what of being is the big damn deal?
How hard is it? Like it's just, I just think anyone famous who has the word doctor in their name, with the exception maybe of like Dr. Dre, just like stop listening to them all. They're all, none of them have any idea what they're talking about.
Well, I think it's really just like this very, I think Dr. Drew's gotten in trouble a few times since COVID for stuff that
absolutely.
And I think he's really hurt his credibility. The guy had a sort of a rockin' best-selling career. He's good looking. He was on all the sort of daytime talk shows. Now, I don't know if it's like an act of desperation to try to grab your last 15 minutes of fame before the curtain comes down. Like, I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, he very famously gave a mea culpa about sort of downplaying everything in the beginning. He's like, yep, yeah, I was wrong about that. And now he's wrong again. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll have Sharon's discussion with the directors of the Oscar-nominated films in the Best Documentary Feature category. Stay tuned.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sharon Waxman. I'm the CEO and the editor-in-chief of The Wrap. We are so happy to have you here for our 2021 Oscar nominees showcase for Best Documentary Films. We are going to be showing you a sizzle of the five films that are nominated for the Academy Award, and then we are going to go into a conversation with directors who are joining us from all over the world, Nicole Noonan of Crip Camp, director Pippa Ehrlich of My Octopus Teacher, director Garrett Bradley for Time, director Alexander Nanauk of Collective, and director Maite Alberti of The Mole Agent. To our audience, please join us with your comments in the chat. Tell us where you're coming from. And we're excited to bring this conversation to you of the highest level of the most celebrated documentary feature directors of the year. It's my pleasure to introduce director Nicole Noonan of Crip Camp, Pippa Ehrlich of My Octopus Teacher, Garrett Bradley of Time, Alexander Nanauk of Collective, and Maite Alberti of The Mole Agent. And let me just say that you all are coming to us from literally all over the world. We've got one of you in Point Reyes, California, Cape Town, South Africa, Santiago, Chile, Bucharest, Romania, and of course, Los Angeles. So this is truly an amazing feat to be able to talk to all of you. And I'm excited that you guys get to talk to each other because I know that sometimes people have been a bit isolated, and getting you all together to get to exchange your ideas, I really shouldn't say very much because I want to hear from all of you. So welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for getting up early, staying up late, or whatever it is you needed to do in whatever time zone you're in. Let's just start by mentioning that, first of all, I have to say this, that four women directors nominated. Alexander, I'm sorry that you're the odd man out, but for once, we're really...
Finally, everything is equal.
In the world we want to live in, you know, the best work rises, and that means work by women and by people of color, and everyone gets a shot. And this year it must be exciting to you because it's exciting to me to see all of your faces and this kind of work celebrated. with four women directors, which is usually not the case. Your films are very different. Many of them deal with issues of social justice, or natural justice, the justice in the natural world. And I would say, particularly in Maite's film, just the questions of human connection. They're all very different, very moving in their own way. I would like to hear from each of you about sort of how these films came to be. Let's start with Garrett. This film about time is so very moving. I refer to the fact that there was a short that preceded it. You have some incredible footage of the life of a woman who is waiting for her husband to come out of prison in the most personal and intimate and absolutely moving way. Tell us about where the film began and how you managed to convince this person to let you come in so close to her life.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Sharon, thank you. And it's like, actually, so great to see you all. We only briefly get to interact with each other, so thanks for facilitating this.
Yes.
I made a short film with the New York Times op docs, and I don't know how many people are watching this, but I always say I didn't know anybody at the New York Times. Anybody can go to the website, newyorktimes.com/opdocs. I submitted an idea. They responded to me 3 months later, and I was able to make this short 13-minute film called Alone, which was looking at incarceration from a woman's point of view, and trying to figure out how to make decisions in her life. And because of the stigma around being in an incarcerated family, there were very few people for her to go to get advice. And so I had really thought of that film as being a facilitation of conversations that were intergenerational between her and other women that were in incarcerated families. And I met Fox Rich in the process of making that film. She's briefly in Alone and makes a very vivid connection between slavery and the prison industrial complex. And the reason for wanting to make time, it was a sort of natural evolution. I've never gone out in the world and said, I want to make a film about this. It is something that's always been in proximity to me in my normal and my everyday life. And I felt very strongly that there was a real absence in the understanding and images of the effects of the facts, the effects of incarceration, and really being able to speak to it from a human perspective, and from a way in which contextualizes love, and intimacy. And time it's a love story that spans over two decades. And it was a natural thing that happened out of the making of a short film.
But how did you get her to give you all of this access?
Well, it wasn't even, two things. One is that I never refer to people as subjects, and I never think about experience or shared experience as access. We are agreeing to make a film together, and the things the spaces that she moves through and the things that she experiences, I am there with my camera to bear witness to. So I think number one, that as sort of a general principle helps to create a level of transparency and clarity in my relationships with people that I'm making films with. And I think understanding what is the intention, why does she want to make this? Why does the family want to make this film? And why do I want to make the film? And does that intention overlap? And they were very clear with me that their story is the story of 2.3 million American families in our country. That's a majority experience. And that their story can offer hope. And so knowing that we were on the same page about what we wanted to say and how we wanted to say it certainly offered, a level of trust. But the tapes, which I think, Sharon, you're referring to in terms of her personal archive,
yes.
I wasn't aware of her archive until we were done filming. And I had said to Fox in that evening, I'll be back in a few months. I'll show you a cut of this 13-minute film. I thought I was making another short. And it ended, she handed me a small bag of what ended up being about 100 hours of her own home personal archive.
Oh, my God.
Wow. But so the structure of the film needed to change, right? The length needed to change. But the intention was not going to change. And I think that's where trust comes in. And trust doesn't go away once you're in post.
Well, I can't even imagine what that feeling was when you opened that bag and you understood what you had in your hands. I mean, that must have been...
Absolutely. I mean, especially in America, like the Black Family Archive it's a political act. It's a form of resistance. It shows us the way we see ourselves, in many cases, the way in which mainstream society does not show us. And when you think about it in a Black Southern context in Louisiana, in particular, where Hurricane Katrina destroyed most of our family archive, there was a lot of weight, you know, a lot of trust that went into her handing this to me.
Mm. Wow. Wow. Well, trust is a good segue to talk to you, Alexander, about your film Collective, which is, how to describe it. Just so for those who haven't seen it yet, but I hope everybody who's watching does see it because it's important. It's about corruption in Romania. By the way, that's a country where I was once a reporter during the revolution in 1989. I'm dating myself, but there was so much devastation in the country among the Eastern Bloc, so much more devastation than some other countries, that it doesn't, that to see how that has played out over the decades since the end of the Ceausescu regime and the move into democracy, it is absolutely heartbreaking. So this is a story of families who demanded answers when their children or young adults were killed in a fire, in a nightclub or of some, or in a rock venue, I suppose, and then many more died after the fire itself, and that should never have happened. How did you get involved in wanting to report this out, and what's been the impact in Romania, I should also ask?
Yeah, thank you, Sharon, for having us. I think I was, you know, this fire became a national tragedy because everybody felt that it could have been him or her or his kids in this venue, because it was a popular venue. People were going to concerts and so forth. And what happened was that demonstrations erupted around the country, where a young generation, in an unprecedented number, basically took the streets to protest against their parents' generation politicians, you know, corrupt, incompetent, populistic politicians. And I felt that it is a turning point, because I left Romania when I was 10, right after the revolution. And I grew up most of the time in Germany, and so I was waiting all the time for a kind of a 68 in Eastern Europe, where the young generation basically really pushes on their parents' generation's world that they tolerated. And I felt that that is a turning point, and it might be that point. And at the same time, we had all this systematic manipulation by the authorities about the healthcare system and how it is perfectly functioning and how it can rescue all these burned patients. Pretty much exactly what we hear now during the pandemic from so many more governments.
Right, right.
But we were aware that it is a manipulation, and the press failed at that time. The press didn't ask the right questions. They just propagated what the authorities were saying, and doctors. And I wanted, my instinct was that I want to make a film about power. I want to understand, who are these people that are in power? Who are these people that can lie in such a manner, knowing that they will kill some of these kids, lying to these parents? But obviously, I had no access to such a power. They were not transparent, and there was one team of journalists that started to investigate that power, right, and to investigate all the lies about the healthcare system and to investigate why these kids died, kept dying in hospitals. And that's where we realized, because I wanted to do an observation documentary from the very beginning, where we realized, okay, so if I don't have access to power to do an observational documentary, then it might be the right way to just shadow the work of investigative journalists that fight with that power and fight for the truth. And that's how we approached basically the journalists and, you know,
so that was one thing that sort of it was in the back of my mind the whole film. They were, is it a sports journalist site? It's a sports news site?
Yeah, it's the Sports Gazette, basically, which is the main sports newspaper, but they do also investigations, and that's the smart thing about it, because when you do sport, when you report on sports, you have a very wide readership.
I see. Okay. Unbiased. Makes sense. So okay.
It's really a threat to politicians when they open this paper and they read investigations about them, because, you know, the readers know that the investigations in a sports paper will be not polarized. It won't be taking sides, let's say.
I see.
And so this journalist had a lot of experience in investigating, but they investigated the sports world, and with it, for sure, politicians that got involved into the sports
world.
I
see. Okay.
Results, politicians had to go to jail after the investigation, so they were known. And the interesting thing is that whistleblowers chose to go to them and trust them, whistleblower from inside the healthcare system, and not the traditional media. That's how they came about to start investigating the healthcare system.
So before you tell me what the impact of the film has been, I do want to ask just functionally how you got some of this video that's so shocking. I still have nightmares about some of the images that I have seen in your films, even though I immediately follow them up with images from Pippa's films, so that makes me feel better because they're so beautiful. But there's really shocking images of people lying in hospital beds, crawling with infection, maggots. You know, I can't get that out of my head. How did you get access to that? Clearly, there were a lot of whistleblowers who really wanted to get this story out.
Yeah, I think that two kind of footages in our film that are, let's say, impactful in a very direct way, and that is the footage of the fire, which has a story.
Yeah,
there was a team of camera persons who were filming the concert. The one leading them was somebody I knew that I helped him with a film of his because he was also a documentary filmmaker, and I heard that he was in the club, that he was hurt very badly, that he, I didn't know if he died or not, but it was clear that he won't make it. And I think after we started the project, I met him by accident in the office of another friend, and he was out of coma and telling his story. And so I sat down, listened to him for an hour, and then I said, Mihai, listen, I started to make a film about this. Don't you want to join the band? Are you capable? I mean, do you feel up to it to come on board of the team? And so he became a very close collaborator and also started to do the sound for the film. And the footage we see in the film is basically the footage from one of the cameras, a Blackmagic pocket camera that was wide angle in front of the stage. And the girlfriend of the cameraman pulled it out by its tripod and the cameraman didn't survive. And the other footage you're mentioning from the patient, it's just the footage that the whistleblower brought in. So it would really, as the whole film is really observational, it's just we just filmed why the journalists were for the first time reviewing what the whistleblower had sent them.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
The impact, I mean, for sure, yeah. It's a long story, but I think that the most important impact in Romania, at least, was that it was seen by a very wide audience of a very young generation, between 16 and 30, most of them. And another
in theaters? No, like it was in theaters?
In theaters, yeah. We had 2 weeks in theaters and had record numbers for a documentary in theaters. And I think the most important thing is that what the journalists have told us, that once the film was out, the number of whistleblowers that came in on a daily basis exploded. So if they had about 10 vetted leads from whistleblowers per day before we launched the film, once we launched it, that went up to 80 to 120 per day.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay. Well, we know that change takes time, and the journey that a lot of these issues that get dealt with in the documentaries, they don't change overnight, but I find that over time they really do. Right. Nicole, the question of sort of hidden footage that rediscovered is a big part of your film Crip Camp, which has this beautiful, beautiful footage from this Camp Jened where disabled young people really just got to be free in a way that is very moving and inspiring. What's the genesis of Crip Camp? And then I'm sure you're going to tell us how you found that footage because we got to hear.
The genesis really came out of my friendship with my co-director, Jim Lebrecht.
He is a kind of legendary documentary sound designer and mixer in the Bay Area, and he's been my sound mixer on my three previous feature documentaries. And over time, Jim and my and through my friendship with him, he really opened my eyes to a different way of understanding disability. I started to see disability as a community and as a culture. One day he took me out to lunch and pitched me some story ideas around disability. They were sort of issues like, you know, looking at siblings of people who were disabled. And just offhandedly, he said, but you know, what I've really always wanted to see is a story about my summer camp. And and I said, why? And he started to tell me about this place. And even just in the telling of it, I kind of felt like Alice going, you know, through the looking glass. Like I started to see things differently. I started to see, you know, I think our history, our American history differently, because I had never really understood that young disabled people were fully a part of this sort of like, you know, revolutionary counterculture movement of the 60s and 70s, and the idea of people kind of coming into their own and finding their voice and understanding their shared experience of oppression at a summer camp sounded so incredible. And then when he mentioned that he thought there was this connection with the exodus of people who left New York after having this, you know, profound experience of liberation and moved out to California and became involved with this epic sit-in, which I had vaguely heard about in, you know, in my hometown of the Bay Area. I was really excited to explore that connection, but we didn't know. I mean, it was very obvious to us from the very beginning that the way to tell the story was from, you know, Jim's personal point of view as kind of a Virgil character bringing you into the story, and then to just really immerse you in the camp. And we didn't have anything more than these amazing black and white pictures.
Yeah.
And so we were thinking, how are we going to do that? Maybe we have to hire young actors and, you know, recreate camp, which we were sort of excited about for a while. And we're starting to make plans to do that. And then Jim said, well, you know, you might want to check out. There was this radical video coalition who stopped by the camp, you know, during the crabs outbreak one summer and stayed for a while. And they handed me the video camera at one point, and I actually, you know, strapped the old Portapak deck on the back of the handlebars of my wheelchair and filmed a tour of the camp. And I was like, oh my God, you know, if that's out there, how incredible. So I just kept looking and finally found a tiny little ad that literally said, crabs outbreak at Camp Jened for the Handicapped, and they were selling it for $6.95 in the back of an old video magazine.
No.
which led me to this beautiful man, Howard Gutstadt, who with his partner Ben Levine had shot all this footage, and they still had it.
By the way, they look like a whole story in and of themselves. You only
I mean, they are. Like,
who is that guy and what is his story? That's what I thought. But anyway.
They totally were. They were a really amazing group, and they were going around doing kind of these pop-up video theaters as community empowerment. So they would film communities, mostly around protest movements of various kinds in New York, and then they would show them the footage back as a means of empowerment on a monitor, because people had never been able to do that before, because this was the very first portable video. And so that was the spirit that they came in with. And so it was this really deeply collaborative, like really radical filming. You know, it wasn't just observational filming. It was like, we're going to do this with you. And that was so...
But imagine you're doing something that radical, and then 2020 you're selling them for $6.95 in the back of a magazine. I mean, they really needed somebody like you to come along.
Yeah. The ad was from the 70s, and they hadn't seen most of the footage since they shot it, actually. They made that one little thing about the crabs outbreak for cable access television back in the 70s. And Jim's dad used to call him up at college and say, hey, Jim, your crabs tape was on again last night. But other than that, like, they hadn't even looked at the footage, because they made it as part of these video theaters to, you know, engage the community in kind of an exploration of themselves. And so we got this hard drive, and it was just like, you know, time traveling back. And
That
gave us the opportunity to kind of try to construct that world for people and bring them into it.
Well, I think that's always kind of the thing that's so exciting about documentary work is, you know, anybody can, you can find a good story, but it's really all about like how you tell it. And in when you get to be sitting in the chairs that you're in, you know, after a record number of documentaries were submitted this year for consideration. And there are lots and lots of other great documentaries, I have to say, that we showed in the phase one consideration portion. So, you know, you have to be thinking so hard about how you tell that story. I know you're not thinking about it in terms of I'm competing with other documentarians. I'm just saying, just for to achieve what you're trying to achieve. Like, it's always astonishing to me, like, how that creativity of each of you and your work, you come up with something different. It's not, you know, there's a million documentaries out there on Netflix right now, and no offense to Netflix, but, you know, there are a lot of talking heads stitched together. That's not what you guys are doing. It's just pretty exciting, which is a good way to turn to you, Pippa, to talk about The Octopus Teacher, My Octopus Teacher, sorry, which is this incredibly beautiful, I felt like I was visiting another planet when I watched your film, and kind of in a way you are, what one is, the viewer is. And you shot this over years. Tell us about the making of this film, which takes you underwater with this marine expert who's going through a midlife crisis and establishes a relationship with an octopus, actually.
Thank you, Sharon, and thank you for having me. And I've met Nicole before, but it's really amazing to meet everyone. So very, very honored to be here. I mean, this film started, you know, years actually before I knew Craig, who was the subject of the film. So most of the filming had already happened before I got involved, actually. Craig is this kind of very dedicated, obsessive individual who had made many, many films, but had really lost his passion for it and lost his sense of purpose completely. And as you see in the film, to find his way back, he kind of started diving every day and swimming every day. And first he adapted his body to the cold. And then he picked up a camera again for the first time in a long time. And Craig needs to have a camera with him everywhere he goes. Anywhere he goes, you'll see a little red tag sticking out of his pocket. And you know that his camera's there. So he started off taking stills and just photographing what he could in the kelp forest. And then one day he found this incredible little octopus that just captivated him. And he covered every aspect of his life that he could. You know, he was completely focused on that.
Can I ask just a functional question? So he's alone down there shooting this footage.
In the beginning, he was alone. Once or twice, he took his son with him, and he took his wife with him. But most of the time, he was going in by himself, spending an hour or so with her and going home and just gathering everything that he could. And sometime into that process, he started seeing things that he couldn't believe. And he called his friend Roger Horrocks, who's a really, really talented underwater cinematographer who lives in Cape Town as well. And when Roger wasn't off around the world, filming for Blue Planet and shows like that, he would go and film with Craig. And that was when, you know, you start going from kind of shaky, handheld, breath-hold diving footage shot on a camera that Craig could carry down to the sea with him every day to some pretty incredible red dragon stuff that Roger got. Yeah. So it is a combination of the two. And then later on, you know, when I came in, we had a huge archive of octopus footage. But what we didn't have were big, beautiful GVs of the kelp forest. And we didn't have shots of Craig in the environment, really. There were some shots that Roger had grabbed and some stuff that he'd been able to self-film. But all the shots that you see of the drone shots of Craig on the surface and the shots of him diving down and kind of looking at things underwater, all of that we had to shoot, as well as all the topside stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, the interview, which was done by my co-director, James Reed.
Right. I wonder if you could have made this film 10 or 20 years ago. Did we have cameras that could take us where he goes and where you go?
I think you could have. I think it would have been difficult, and there would have been much bigger cameras and much shakier grainier footage because, you know, it's dark underwater, so you need good sensors. But I think you could have, I mean, I think the amazing thing about octopuses is they've been around for millions and millions of years. So that part of the story would have been similar. You just would have needed that kind of out there individual who had the desire to find out as much as Craig did.
And then you have a truly natural arc to the story of your film, which when you're doing documentaries, you also can't predict unless you're going back and doing something that's, you know, in history, like say Nicole was. But did you know when you started the film where it was going to end? Did you already have that ending? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to ruin the ending, but we're not ruining the ending. The octopus eventually dies. I hope I'm not ruining this for anybody, but.
No, Craig has shown me the rushes right in the beginning when we were talking about starting the film. And I remember when I saw those shots of the octopus at the end of her life for the very first time, I kind of cried watching them and I was surprised by that.
Yeah.
But we knew that we had, you know, 48 years of human life and a full year of octopus life, and we had to fit it all together in a 90-minute film.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a couple of moments that made me cry as well. That wasn't the one for me. It was really when the octopus reaches out a tentacle and touches Craig's face. It was, you know, I mean, it was so stunning. Like, I couldn't actually believe what I was seeing, you know.
Yeah, there was a lot I couldn't believe what I was seeing when I first looked at the rushes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's very exciting. Maite, your film is very different. Again, you're telling the story of a senior citizen's home, and you're sketching the kind of a character study of this. You call him the mole agent. It's a funny name. Who's there to essentially to pretend to be a resident of the senior citizen's home, but in fact he's been hired to check on the welfare of somebody who's in the home. How did this story end up on your desk?
Well, it was a long journey how this story arrived to my desk. Like, I think that, yeah, it didn't arrive to my desk. I always go out to my desk to try to find stories. Right. And in this case, like, and if I wait in my desk to someone to knock the door, probably I cannot make any documentary. So I start, like, thinking on topics. And in this case, I realized that a lot of ex-FBI started to make their own private agencies in Chile, and they were like making cases to change in the new legal system. So there was an increase of private detective agencies, and that was my starting point. And I researched in all the private detective agencies what kind of cases do they work on, and I interview almost all of them, and Romulo, the main character, was the only one that allows me to enter to his office to see in the field the kind of cases. And the cases that I was more committed with was the mole agent cases in general. At the beginning, I thought to make a TV series with each episode per mole, like parents that want to follow their kids, like crazy day-by-day cases that I feel that you don't need a private detective to resolve. And I felt that the private detective, all of them told me, like, with the increase of the social networks, they started to have more cases, because as more information do the people have from Facebook or Twitter or about others, they want to know more, and that create more anxious, and they have more cases now than before. Mm-hmm. So that was my starting point. Like, why are the people researching? And when I see the case of the retirement home during the research period, that he usually worked with these kind of cases, and a lot of agencies also have these cases, it was like, why the people is researching this? Like, what is the sense of this? And And that was the starting point, and also was a case that was completely committed with my previous topic about old age and loneliness. And Chile is the country that the highest rate of suicides, it's the people between 80 and 90 years old because they feel alone and loneliness. And that was a topic that I was already committed. So it was for me the perfect match, like this case and my own obsessions. So we were supposed to shoot the film with the mold that he usually worked with in these kind of cases, but he broke his hip like 3 weeks before start. So that's why Romulo decided to put an ad in the newspaper, and Sergio arrives as appears in the first scene like a lucky gift for me. I was desperate, and I thought that, okay, we didn't have a film if we lose the mold.
Right.
He was the one that completely changed the focus of the of my original idea, that was more like the film noir, private detective documentary, like trying to reach other genres inside documentary, like to think that film noir is not only territory of fiction. But as Sergio was not really taking care of the case and he was more committed with his experience, he changed the focus and he changed the film, and that it's like the gift at the end for me and of the film, that it's like the private detective world, it's only a starting point to speak about the topic that he really researched. And I always say it like he was the worst spy in the world, but in the other hand, he made like a super good anthropological research. Like he really understand how was the people living there and not in the private detective world, kind of good detective to send proofs by the phone, to shoot the correct things. It was completely more deep.
Yeah, yeah. And did you have, you kept a distance from all of this? Like it was just unfolding the story on its own, or were you kind of shaping the story?
No, I cannot shape the story because as Sergio was going to be there as a mole agent, and nobody can suspect about us, and as I know him right from before inside the retirement home, if I gave any instruction to Sergio during the training, he was going to be used to receive my instruction inside, and I couldn't do that. So it was a super, like, I knew what kind of things Romulo were going to ask to him because I knew his world, but everything was from Romulo. And inside the retirement home, for me, he was one of the characters that I was following as all the ladies. And I entered before him, and all the ladies adapt to us and adapt to the camera. And we learn first how to shoot on that place, how to shoot them. And when we were like super adapt, he entered as the new one. So he was one of the all the characters that we were shooting and we were following. So I could not give like instructions yet to him.
Well, it sounds like you still could do a series if you wanted to do a series, and maybe
it's take me 6 years to do this. Like it's I can spend all my life making that series. Like
if it's yes, by the time you're done with the series, you'll be in the retirement home. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, probably I can make the film because now, like Sergio always say, like someday he's going to go to live to the retirement home. So probably I can make the film when he come back to the retirement home.
Part two. Exactly. Okay. I'd love to ask all of you, I'm presuming that all of these films were made not during the pandemic, that they all were made in time for 2020. Regardless though, everybody has surprises and challenges along the way, especially in making documentaries. Like Maite is just talking about her main character disappearing 3 weeks before filming. Can you sort of, anyone jump on in, talk about surprises or, you know, particular challenges that you had to figure out how to work around or work with on your films?
Yeah.
Garrett?
Oh, no, please.
No, I was saying Garrett. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think one of the biggest challenges was, which was not related to COVID, but, you know, that being able to see inside prisons, you know, Angola, you know, is a penitentiary that's in Louisiana. It was multiple plantations that were consolidated into a single plantation that was nicknamed after the people that were brought from the country of Angola to this land. It's 18,000 acres of property.
Wow.
The father of the Richardson's family, you know, Robert, was there for over 2 decades. The film is very much about a family's pursuit in reuniting themselves and what daily resistance looked like for them and staying together in the context of love, right? And unity and not being defined by the system. But I will say that even the fanciest drone, the most expensive 6,000K whatever drone that we could get our hands on, still could only capture a fraction of that 18,000 acres of land. And I'm pointing this out just because when we think about the Vietnam War, when we think about how people for the first time being able to see images of war and that making them angry enough to want to be involved, to want to stop war from happening. When we think about Emmett Till's mother, who had the brilliance of understanding why the casket needed to stay open because it would hold systems accountable in a way that nothing else would. Images, being able to see things, is in itself a political act, right? And when we think about the prison industrial complex, when we think about it not only in an American context, but a global one, the only evidence sometimes of what's happening is in the family, is in those that are serving time on the outside. So I think the innate challenge for us was trying to show the actual scope of what incarceration is, doing it in a way that again was deeply rooted in the joy and the celebration and the resistance of everyday families.
I love that you use that word resistance. You're probably used to saying it a lot, but I didn't actually think about it until this conversation in relation to the story of this family, but it's exactly what it is. It's not just human need or love. It's all those things, but thinking of it as an active, daily act of resistance is a really great way to frame it. Anyone else have pleasure? Yes, Maite.
I want to say that if I shoot at the Mall Agent in 2020, probably I will shoot exactly the same film because that people was already locked down. They was already isolated. And the owner of the retirement home told me all the time, our life didn't change. Like, I have to close the door because we have a strict lockdown of 7 months here last year. But my doors were already closest, like we didn't have visitors, my funeral was without family members, these people was really abandoned. So the lockdown made conscious to the people that was abroad or that was not inside about how much time passed without visiting the people that they love, and they start calling, but they were already like in a pandemic of the loneliness living there. And for distribution, I feel like from an independent film from Chile, it was super frustrating to don't have theatrical, but at the same time, I had a lot of opportunities that probably I will not have in another context. I see like this film started to be like for old age audience because they see it at homes and not in theaters. So all the family was seeing the film, and of course that no parents will came to see this film with an 7 years old to the cinema, but in the house they stayed with kids, and this has been a super great opportunity as a family film that I never thought as a family film. And I also think that in this nomination from an independent film from Chile without a big streaming behind, without a studio, like the way to make campaign, it was more democratic this year without that a big kind of events that they will never pay. And I think it was more, democratic probably.
That's good. Pippa, Nicole, Alexander, any of you guys want to jump in?
No, I think that for us, the biggest challenge in making a film was to actually be able to visualize these young people from Gen Ed going forth and sort of creating this movement, taking part in this historic sit-in and changing the world, which was the point of the narrative, but the history had really been suppressed and forgotten and overlooked.
Like actively suppressed, or you think just like?
No, I think just like put away. I mean, there's one of the lines that is powerful to me in the film is from this activist Corbett O'Toole, and she says disabled people know that people want us dead. And I think, like incarcerated people and like people, like old people who are in institutions, these are populations of people that we are not seeing. We're not seeing in the media, we're not seeing in our daily life. And so, the history was really gone. A lot of the archives were literally just thrown away. But there'd be like, a big series, and they had every single other tape in the series, but they were missing the one that had the footage that we needed. So it was really like a multi-year effort to just scrap together shots. We would take a shot from an old DVD and a shot from an old 3/4-inch tape that we found in a file box. We would go in and some disability rights organization would have given all their whole archive over to a university, but nobody had ever opened the boxes and itemized what was in it. And it took us 2 years just to get the access to be able to, to see what was in the boxes, things like that. So
wait a minute, it took you 2 years to get access?
Yeah, because people, libraries are... Yeah, libraries are underfunded, and they were like, "Well, we never went through and itemized these things, and we don't have a budget for doing that." So it was just like pushing to try to just kind of like mosaic it back together, and then find our people within it.
That's amazing. I hope people appreciate that, because like you don't know that as a viewer. You're just like, "Oh yes, this is an interesting snippet. Oh, here we are inside the." HH whatever office where the sit-in was. I'm going to get it wrong. Yeah. The is it housing and health or welfare?
Health, education, and welfare, yeah.
Close. Okay. Yeah, they're sitting in day after day after day, and here's a couple of congressmen. That moment where you have Joseph Califano's deputy sitting in the corner listening to the testimony of these disabled protesters, that was amazing.
Yeah, that fragment of film has been out there. That is one that is very well known in disability circles, and a lot of young activists were transformed by seeing that, and that was one of the things that was really motivating for us around making the film, was just being able to show this, because we knew it was going to, we hoped it would spark more protests and change.
Well, but it also for many people, I think it provides a through line, so we understand of like, we all know there's an American Disabilities Act, but like how we got there,
Yeah, we look at it as like almost charity, I think, typically. People look at it and say, well, we did this nice thing for people, and not this is something that was so right. Hard fought for.
Yeah, and a right that just was a dead letter for so many years as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, Alexander or Pippa, either one of you, please jump on in. Mm-hmm.
Pippa, do you want to go first? Or? No?
You go first, Alexander.
Yeah, I think that for us it was maybe, the effort to capture all the different storylines, and when we started to have access also to inside the Ministry of Health, I was shooting basically the same day in the two different trenches, being witness to, to what is happening in a newsroom that was investigating basically the ministry in which I was shooting. And I think a very important thing was that we all knew, and that was basically understanding, we are all professionals. I will never talk with any of the two sides, what I see on the other side. So, and that was a real effort, to follow the investigation, to try to get access to the whistleblowers and how they meet the journalists, and then really at the same time trying to capture how basically the people in the ministry deal with their ongoing effort of reforming this corrupt system, but also how they deal with all the bombs that would go off in the ministry once the investigations started on the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And that at the same time, knowing that we were surveilled, my phone was tapped by the Secret Service, So it meant that every night after an intense shooting day, which basically every shooting day was pretty intense, we had to copy our footage onto multiple sources, hide it, bring it out of the country. So I think the challenge was just to stay alert for 1 year, day by day, and really try to understand the world we were filming, try to understand the fight of the journalists, try to understand how the administration basically works inside a ministry, try to understand how the media attacks the journalists, but also this minister. I think the complexity of it was the challenge, but also the satisfaction, because it really demands a high level of focus and concentration that really is also charging you at the same time.
I mean, it's just a good reminder of what it is to be doing investigative documentary work in a country where the freedom of the press is something that is, maybe it formally exists, doesn't have deep roots, let's just say.
Yeah, it doesn't have deep roots, but it's still, I mean, it exists. The problem is not that it's not able to say the truth. The problem is that the system is well enough prepared to hide the truth. So it resembles totally so many different countries around the world, including the US.
Oh, yes, we have many problems with that in the US. but that's for another time. Pippa, please tell us something in particular that surprised you or really challenged you in your film, in making your film.
I think there were many challenges along the way, but the biggest one in the end was for us to think about how we were going to package our message and really what the message of our film was, because there was a big team of us. It's not just James and me and Craig. There's a big team of people behind every film, I suppose. And a lot of us are environmental filmmakers and natural history filmmakers. And mm-hmm. we knew we had this really powerful and emotional story on our hands. And we also know that we're living in this very, very frightening time on Earth where we're dealing with global warming and rainforests are being chopped down and animals are going extinct at a rate that we have never experienced before. And we knew that, we felt quite a deep responsibility to say something that spoke to that. But I also knew, and not all of us have the same opinion, but I, as a conservation journalist especially, had written so many stories about the destruction of people in nature and watched so many films about, the impact of human beings on the natural world, and often very, very scary and make you feel very sad, and incredibly important films. But what I hadn't seen so much of and what I was fascinated by is a story of what the impact of nature is on a human being. And that was really why that was the story we wanted to stay true to, and we felt like the kind of fragility of humankind within the huge environmental community that we're part of, which includes all kinds of weird or wonderful creatures, and sharing a sense of awe and even reverence for the living planet would be a more powerful message. And it was a pretty terrifying thing to do. It took a lot of courage, and we questioned if we'd done the wrong thing and if we'd missed a very important opportunity for making an important impact. It was literally, up until the very night before the film launched that we questioned that decision. But in the end, I'm happy we went the way we did.
Well, I guess that's what makes you an artist. You do something very scary and you jump in and you do it anyway. Well, I just want to thank all of you. I feel so honored to have been able to meet you and to hear from you in this very unusual and untraditional way, which is talking to you guys live all over the world, just weeks ahead of the Academy Awards. We usually try to do this in person, but there's something very moving about actually getting to do this, you know, from where you are in your different locations and seeing how your stories have already impacted the world, but will continue to resonate. It's just that one message that for each of you in your particular places, I just want to remind you, if you're not sure, that your stories are changing the world. And thank you for them. Thank you very much. And that is it for this week's episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all our listeners, and remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.